Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa.
It's good to be here and talking about church history. We've had some fantastic programs, and today we're going to continue. Last week we did Origen,
right.
And you were telling me before that this, he is sixth generation.
Right.
And today we're going to continue in the sixth generation.
Yes. Yeah, we'll be looking at the title of this is The Sixth Generation, Church in Peace and in Persecution. And we really have been. Last time around, we talked about Origen of Alexandria, one of the greatest and most innovative theologians of Christianity. And I had mentioned also that he had met Hippolytus when he went to Rome.
Right.
That was actually the program before that.
Mm-hmm.
And next time around, we're going to come back and talk about Cyprian of Carthage, which is also sixth generation. So we're actually spending about three or so programs just on that generation. It's very important. For one thing, it tells us that we're halfway through the program.
Because
it's 12 generations, and this is the sixth one. It's also pivotal because after this, there'll be a series of persecutions like there had never been before. And these are really going to be persecutions to destroy the church ultimately. And after they fail, then everything else takes off. But the church is going to be very, very badly damaged as a result of these. So we'll be looking today then at the church at a time in peace and in persecution. They're going to experience both of these. The guy that's sort of the headliner for all of this is the Emperor Commatus.
Okay.
And he inherited the kingdom at the age of 19 years old.
Wow.
Now, despite the programs that we had a couple years ago, there was the movie The Gladiator with Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the portrayal of Commatus was not totally inaccurate, but there were inaccuracies to it. The fact of the matter is that he inherited the empire from Marcus Aurelius, his father. He was not interested in running the empire. We have this impression that he killed his father in order to become emperor. At least the movie showed that. That's not true. He was more interested in horses and in athletic games in the arena. And so therefore, from the very beginning, he allowed others to govern the empire, which was a good move,
mm-hmm.
But he also pampered the Praetorian Guard, his private guard, with high salaries, benefits, all kinds of gifts. And as time went on, he slowly began, over his administration, replacing these really good advisors with friends and fellow sports enthusiasts.
Okay.
Did not particularly make good decisions. Governance fell into poor order. There were clashes with the Senate, who was used to good governance. Certainly remember, they had a whole series of what is referred to in Roman history as the five good emperors.
Mm-hmm.
Commatus is not going to be one of those. And so they're not happy about that. They voiced their opinion. They've been used to voicing their opinion. The Senate was respected during this particular set of administrations. And now what they found instead was senators were being taken out and executed. So there was a reign of terror that was being introduced. At one point, Commatus' brother-in-law actually tried to assassinate him. He bungled the job. And the end result was that in the investigations and the tortures that took place afterwards, other senators' names came up. Other senators now were also executed. Eventually, things got really weird when he just began acting weird, and even so much so as to dressing like a charioteer. That was not that uncommon. Nero had done the same thing. But even as a gladiator, and not just dressing like a gladiator, but actually going, here is the emperor of the Holy, of the, nothing wrong about it, of the Roman Empire, going into the arena and actually fighting like a gladiator, except he always won. He was not killed by Russell Crowe, though. Okay. What happened instead was that his girlfriend poisoned him. A woman by the name of Marcia, and she had a gladiator come in and finish him off. This was in 193 AD. He had been emperor for 13 years. Now the empire was about to lurch into a time of chaos and brutality. What happens is that the assassins themselves persuade one of the last really good men of Rome, a man by the name of Pertinax, to become emperor. And he's got huge, huge problems going on. For one thing, the Roman Empire had just experienced the plague that decimated the population of the empire. Remember, the word decimation comes from decem, one-tenth. At least one-tenth of the population of Rome was wiped out. Besides that, in the east, the Parthians were on the march. That's present-day Iran. And they were pushing into present-day Iraq and Syria and western part of Turkey, which at all were allies, if not totally under the control of the empire, the Roman Empire. So that's a real challenge coming in from that area. From the north, the Germans were beginning to push in. And that's going to be a real problem. One particular group of Germans called the Goths are leaving out of central Russia and moving their way in toward the Roman Empire. But as they come along, they're going to knock other Germanic tribes who will then move further and further west.
Okay.
And that's going to put pressure on the empire too. On top of that, there is an air of revolt in Spain and in Britain. Even the populations of those areas are sick and tired of paying taxes, and they didn't believe they're getting their fair share back. And there are people in Spain that are saying, you know, we could break away and be our own country. I mean, let's call ourselves Spain. And then up in Britain, there were talking about, these are Romans who were talking about forming their own country. That's going to be a real problem. So Pertinax had his hands full, and he also didn't have a lot of really good help. And the reason for that was, you have to go back a couple other emperors. The Emperor Hadrian had separated the education of the leadership in Rome into two groups, those who would serve as civilians and those who would serve as military. Typically, the military and civilian role was one and the same throughout the Republic and into the empire, but Hadrian professionalizes especially the military. And so a young man, let's say he's in his early teens, and he's up and coming, and he's received the basic education, and he's being prepared by his family for civil service. The family, himself, others would determine whether or not that civil service would come in the form of the military or in the form of civilian government.
Okay.
And his education then would spin off in one of those two directions. If it went toward the military, it would actually be much better trained. The leadership skills and the ability to lead and to solve problems is much better. Unfortunately for the politicians, as sometimes happens, they get involved in the good old boy network and they're less educated and they're less refined. And unfortunately then, what you have is a very destructive thing where the military are going to be the people you can rely on and the civilian not as much so.
Okay.
And so the end result then is that Pertinax finds himself not able to do the good governance that is needed, that had shriveled up over the time that Commodus had been the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, the Praetorian Guard goes to Pertinax and says, hey, by the way, we haven't had a raise for the last 6 months. And he basically said to them, look, you've been pampered too much already. Live with what you've got and lump it. And they turned around and killed him.
Oh.
Yeah. Then what they did was the Praetorian Guard simply announced all throughout the empire, all throughout Rome, next emperor, it's up for grabs. You pay us. It's an auction.
Wow.
They actually put the emperorship on the auction block, and one of the senators stepped forward, a very wealthy man by the name of Didius Julianus. And Didius Julianus is an example of how you can lose a fortune overnight.
Uh-huh.
Because he paid all that money to the Praetorian Guard. He is announced then as the emperor, and almost immediately up in Germany, there are the Roman legions up there that say, we're not going to stay, take this. This guy, who is he anyway? We're not going to take orders from him. We have a really wonderful general. This is a guy who really knows how to lead. And they turn to him, Septimus Severus, if you want to be emperor, we're the guys that will do it for you. And he goes, okay, fine. marches down to Rome, takes over, and, you know, poor Didius Julianus was disinherited overnight. The Praetorians are pretty good, but the fact of the matter is they're no match for an entire Roman legion, and so they were disbanded. They were simply kicked out. And now to make things all the worse, even more insulting, and Septimus Severus is—he's a very strong leader. You know, Severe and Severus have the same root, and he also has a way of insulting people too and making them accept it. Instead of the Praetorian Guard, he brought in as his private bodyguard. He brought in a group of Parthians. He hired these Parthians in as his bodyguard. Now, the Parthians are the enemies of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just trying to think about what this would look like. It would be like the President of the United States gets rid of the Secret Service and gets rid of the Marines at Quantico, okay, turns around, and for his own protection, he hires in, let's say, a couple hundred Taliban or Al-Qaeda. This makes no sense at all. You know, it's a huge insult to the nation. And yet, that's exactly what Septimus Severus did. That's not enough. On top of that, it's him himself. Although he has a Roman name, he is not Roman. He was actually born in North Africa. Now, there are a lot of Romans who moved to North Africa and were at least part Roman, part North African. St. Augustine later on would be an example of that.
Right.
His father, Patricius, was from was of Roman stock. His mother, Monica, was probably Berber, North African. Well, in the case of Septimus Severus, both sides of his family did not ever trace themselves back to Rome or to Italy. He was a North African. To make it even worse, he was a Carthaginian.
Okay.
He spoke Punic as his first language. Now, the greatest enemy in the history of the entire Roman civilization was Hannibal Barca, the Carthaginian. I mean, even at the time of Septimus Severus, mothers used to scare their kids when they weren't obeying. They would shout out to the kids, Hannibal ad portas, Hannibal's at the gate, and the kids would scream. They'd heard so many stories about the Second Punic War, and now all of a sudden, they've got a Punic as their emperor. Now, if that's not enough, turns out that he's married to a Syrian. Okay? Her name is Julia Domna, but that's her Romanized name.
Mm-hmm.
Her actual name was Martha, Martha of Baal. She was a priestess of the god Baal. And when she arrived in Rome, with her husband now as the emperor, she actually opened up a temple to the Syrian god Baal. And began proselytizing.
Wow.
This is pretty bad stuff. Nobody would dare lift a finger, though.
Right.
You know, they were afraid of him. He brought law and order, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he was also brutal. In one case, there was a legion in the east that rose up and tried to make their own general the emperor. He came in, conquered that legion. They were supported by a little fishing village by the name of Byzantium. He went through and slaughtered the city, the town. Later, there was a revolt in Gaul. There was a Roman by the name of Albinus who tried to establish a country of Gaul. And he was defeated also by Septimus Severus. Albinus had been supported by the city of Lyon. And he went in and devastated Lyon. He dismantled the aqueduct system. So that, that Lyon would turn into a small town. The interesting thing is the people whom he punished are the grandchildren of the people who had martyred St. Blandina and all those other martyrs of Lyon and Vienne.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the grandchildren of them, and this terrible event is visited upon them. Lyon is located in a spot in France that you can't keep it down. It's a very important river city, and so eventually it will come back, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the kind of man you're dealing with, very rough. there's one bright side to all of this, and the bright side is that he knew that he knew nothing about civil government. And so he tried to reform civil government while not knowing anything about it, and so he brought in experts. And two of them in particular, one of them was a man, a lawyer, actually, from Syria, Papianios, and he oversaw the reform of the Roman courts, and a greater sense of jurisprudence, rule of law, which had been, that was the foundation of Roman civilization, but unfortunately over a period of time it had swayed considerably. Ultimately, his own successor is another man, actually from Lebanon. His name is Ulpian of Tyre, and he's going to take these Roman laws and extend them even further, particularly, and he's going to humanize them so that there are going to be basic rights for slaves. That had never been done before. There's a normalization of the rights of people in the provinces, and there's the introduction of a human and humane criteria for law. Ultimately, this is going to have a wonderful effect as we get into the time of Justinian and his creation of the Corpus Iuris Civilis. But here's the beginning of all of that. But by golly, you better keep out of the way of the emperor. You know, as long as you're finding yourself
within
in court, that's one thing, but keep away from him. In 201, he arrives in Egypt.
Now, is this Severus or Ultimus?
This is Septimus Severus.
Okay.
I'm sorry, yeah.
Okay.
My antecedent's there.
That's right.
Yeah, the emperor arrives in Egypt, and he looks around, and he doesn't like what he sees, and immediately launches a persecution of Christians. This is the persecution in which Origen's father was rounded up and killed.
Okay.
It's said that Origen himself, remember, he became the head then of the catechetical school in Alexandria. That persecution continued on for a significant period of time, and it was said that Origen trained his catechumens to go from baptism to martyrdom. It was that fast.
Wow.
And many of them did. Just really incredible.
Amazing.
Yeah, yeah. There's one example of this in which there's a police roundup and five men and three women are arrested all at once, and one was a woman by the name of Potemiania, and she was a Christian. And she was captured, and she announced her Christianity, Christiana sum, and her guard, she had a guard there standing right next to her, and his name was Basiliades, and when the crowds tried to attack her, he actually protected her. Now, ultimately, she's going to be martyred,
mm-hmm.
but the bottom line was that 3 days after her martyrdom, this guards stepped forward and announced that he also was a Christian. And then right after that, he was taken out and beheaded. So the martyrologies are just filling up with people during these persecutions.
So, right.
Yeah. This will be the same wave that's going to continue on into 203 AD, in which both Perpetua and Felicity are killed, also in North Africa. Well, in the middle of this little fun fest that the emperor is having with killing Christians and routing out Christians, word comes that there's a group of people in northern Britain who are coming over the border. Remember, Hadrian had built a wall to keep these people out. They're called the Picts, and they're the ancestors of the Scots today. And they're on the march, and so with this, Septimus Severus gathers himself up, leaves Egypt, and goes off to Britain in order to fight the Picts. He brings with him his family, his entourage, and particularly two sons. And while he's there in northern Britain, in the city of York, he dies. And this is in 2:11. And he says to his two sons, he gives them dual emperorship, so they're to rule equally. And he gives them this advice: get along, enrich the troops, forget everything else. Okay. His two sons are Geta and Caracalla. Geta was a very nice young man. He was tall, thin, given to refinements, played musical instrument, loved poetry and literature and things like that. Caracalla was a brute. He was severe, just like Daddy. And no sooner had Daddy died, Geta realized he was going to be in trouble. And so he fled to his mother. This is Julia Domna, and she had come along with them. And so he's with her when his assassins arrive. His brother immediately sent out men to kill him,
his
brother. And so there they were. They literally, they attacked Geta. They had to take and grab Julia Domna and pull her away. They literally pulled this mother's son away from her and then slaughtered him right there before her eyes. He had friends. You know, Geta was a guy that you would like. You'd like to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And so these assassins then rounded up somewhere between 20 and 30 other friends of Geta, and they pulled him into a small field, sort of a backyard of a building, and they slaughtered them all, these 20 to 30 men. We know this from Roman historians, but in the last 10 years, there was an excavation that was done in a yard in York, and they came across some 20 or so ancient bones, ancient Romans, who had, each of them had been beheaded. And so this is the spot where this actually happened. And now we have archaeological evidence of it actually taking place. Kind of an interesting sort of a thing. Then also word went out throughout the empire that of these men, and also Geta, that they were to experience what's known in it's an old Roman practice called the damnatio memoriae, the damnation of memory, so that any name, any time your name appears, it would be wiped out. So in any monument that you had, anything you wrote, it would be destroyed, so that it would be as if you had never lived.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty rough stuff.
That's mean.
With this, Caracalla then began to prepare an attack. He was going to invade Parthia. I began talking as if he were the new Alexander the Great. And when he gets to Alexandria itself in order to raise troops, it turns out that the people of Alexandria did not support him. And so he brought all of the young men of the city into an amphitheater and had them slaughtered. So he was a pretty bad guy.
Wow.
Finally, it got to be too much even for his own followers. And the chief of guards, a Moor by the name of Macrinus, killed him. And the guards were so happy that they acclaimed him as emperor. Well, so Macrinus then goes to Rome and begins consolidating his position and all this. But he hadn't counted on Caracalla's mother, Julia, remember Domna. And also Caracalla had an aunt. But the two of them were packed up. They were sent out of Rome and sent back to Syria, where they were to be priestesses back at their old haunt in this little city of Emesa. Well, okay, fine. Both of Julia Domna's sons are dead, but the aunt, her sister, Julia Maesa, had two grandchildren by two separate daughters. And so they began plotting to eventually bring these two children back to the throne. They waited their time. One of them, by the way, his name was Elagabalus, and he's named after a fetish stone. Okay. El Gabal.
Okay.
Okay, that's an Arab term. An interesting little aside there. And then the other one was Alexander Severus.
Okay,
we'll see both of these. Actually, we've talked about Alexander Severus already. Remember, his mother took instructions in the faith.
Right.
Well, they waited for the right moment, and Macrinus had a military defeat, and that was their sign then for them to strike. And what they did was they hired troops. They overthrew Macrinus the Moor, and then established themselves again back in Rome, making the one son, Elagabalus, as emperor. This is an absolute insult. Here is a boy who has been elevated as the high priest of Assyrian sun god. The Roman historian, or the historian of Roman history, a man by the name of Cyril Robinson, says this: "There can be little doubt, however, that this curious creature took himself very seriously." Now, here's an important part of this. When Elagabalus becomes the emperor, he sends over to Syria and brings Elagabal, the fetish stone, to Rome to be worshipped by the Romans. Now, the Romans are not real happy about this.
Right.
Added to that, he makes the huge mistake of marrying a Vestal virgin.
Ooh.
Yeah. And what he's doing, and you know, for whatever reasons, maybe he was a curious creature, but he had this sense that he was the one who would bring together all of the religions of the world into one faith. And he had this prayer. I'd like to, we have time to read this,
okay,
this prayer. This is a prayer that was composed, and it's kind of interesting, and it has something to do with us Christians. The prayer goes like this. This is actually a goddess speaking.
Okay.
"Lo, I am here, called up by your prayers, mother of nature, ruler of all the elements, firstborn of eternity, highest of the gods, queen of the departed, first of the heavenly beings, the single form of gods and goddesses, the single form of gods and goddesses." So all these gods and goddesses are manifestations. Here's modalism in a pagan sense, okay? "The shining facade of the sky, the health-giving winds of the sea, the silence of the dead, all this do I govern by my nod. The whole circle of the earth worships my soul Godhead under various forms." My Godhead under various forms. "With changing customs and many names, Phrygians as the mother of the gods, Athenians as Athena, Cypriots as Aphrodite, Cretans as Artemis, Sicilians as Persephone, Eleusians as Demeter, others as Hera, Bellona, Hecate or Nemesis, the Egyptians who are the light, who are lighted by the rays of the rising sun, the Aryans and the Egyptians who possess a most ancient wisdom, worship me with observance proper to me, for my name, my real name, Queen Isis." So what he's saying here is, in that little prayer that's composed, is that there is only one God, which is the Queen Isis, but everybody else sees that deity through various pictures, different ways of looking at it. The important thing for us, and why this is important for us, is that ultimately the Romans are not going to buy that.
Right.
But what they are going to buy is the idea that there is, in fact, only one God. And that God is, at least if it is not physically, it's at least represented by the sun, S-U-N. And since the sun rises and sets every day, and we can rely on the sun, and it wanes and comes back every year, the length of the days, therefore, this is the sole invictus. It is the unconquered sun. And the day for the feast of that unconquered sun is December 25th. And so we've already talked about Christmas before and how Christians came up with the date for Christmas. But really, the Christians were responding to this monotheism, this Romanized monotheism, by saying, well, you kind of got it right, but you got it wrong. You know, let me sit down and tell you about the real God.
Right.
And that's how Elagabalus fits into all of this. Well, basically, you know, he's a weird little boy. And he begins doing some things that really upset the Senate and everybody else. He makes state honors, gives state honors to an acrobat because he performs well, a charioteer, a barber, that did it. And so the Praetorian Guard, who had come back by now, was brought back, they killed him. And they proclaimed his cousin as emperor. Now, his cousin is 13 years old.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And so by now, both of the grandmas are gone. And so we have Alexander Severus's mother, Mamaea, Julia Mamaea, who now takes over as sort of like empress regent or queen regent. And what she does is she appoints 16 senators to actually run the government for her son, and then turns over the Praetorian Guard to the jurist Ulpian of Tyre, who now reforms the guard just as he had done reforming the courts. So things are off to a good start, it seems. And then she herself goes back over to the east, where she receives Christian instructions from Origen of Alexandria. Right. However, this is 222, and while it looks as though things are going well, I mean, you've got a regent, or a regency with the 16 hopefully wise senators. Mom is going back and getting out of politics and all that. The other side of this is that the empire is very fragile at this particular moment. They just had a bunch of assassinations. And also the Severans, one of the ways they were able to continue running the government was to debase the currency, which causes inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge inflation raging in the Roman Empire at the time. The army is not able to man ships. They couldn't get enough sailors. The Romans have never been great sailors to begin with. And so the Roman Navy now goes into a decline. When that happens, you end up with pirates in the Mediterranean. So we had Johnny Depp with a Latin accent, you know, speaking Latin. Taxes are higher and harder to collect. What happens is that, and the agriculture is not doing well, and so what happens is that the troops begin collecting the taxes on their own, and since they don't want money because it's debased currency anyway, they want in-kind payment. So either as they come through, they're going to take your cattle from you, they're going to harvest your crops and take those away from you. They will force you to work. To do forced work. It's a system that remained in Europe all the way down to the French Revolution, called the corvée. And then if it's not bad enough internally, externally, again, Persia is on the rise. In 227, actually began conquering right on the borders of the Roman Empire, pressing in. In 231, an entire Roman army was defeated. Alexander Severus went out with a second army and realized that he couldn't support the army that had just been defeated, so he begins to retreat himself. In 234, the Germans attack. He brings his army up to the Germans, but Alexander's afraid to use them because he had seen what happened, how badly they performed with the Parthians. And so he says to the Germans, he said, "We'll pay you not to attack us." And these Roman troops go, "What do you mean? Don't you think we're any good?" So they killed him.
Ooh.
Yeah. And his mother.
Mm.
Well, now we end up with basically 50 years of chaos. Once you get into the around 250 AD, give or take 15, 20 years in either direction, things are just really miserable. The fact that the Roman Empire survived at all after 250 is remarkable in itself. There are two emperors who are going to have great control in this, but these two emperors are going to be absolutely brutal. One of them is Maximus of Thrace, and the other one is Decius of Illyricum. We'll talk about them in a couple minutes. And yet, below the radar screen, things are going on within the church, and the church is still continuing to grow. And I'd like to take a look at some of that. Remember we said that during one of the earlier persecutions that St. Clement of Alexandria had fled from Alexandria and went to Cappadocia, which is a very wild, mountainous area of present-day Turkey. And there he stayed. He lived out the rest of his life, and we believe he died in that area too. He stayed with a former pupil of his, a man by the name of Alexander, who had been made the bishop of Neo-Caesarea of, there are two Neo-Caesareas, but this one is up in Asia Minor, and up in Cappadocia.
Okay.
And so Clement then spent the remainder of his life, and then he died there. Eventually, the persecutions under Caracalla even got to Cappadocia, and Alexander was arrested. He was put into prison. He was tortured. But Caracalla died before he was martyred. And so as a sign of thanksgiving, Bishop Alexander of Neo-Caesarea went on a pilgrimage, and he went to Aelia Capitolina, which is the Roman name for Jerusalem. Okay, and so he went to, and this becomes a very important pilgrimage, and he went down there basically to visit the holy sites, the site of Jesus' birth, the site of Jesus' death, the burial site, you know. And the reason he was able to do that was that the Christian population in that city had held those sites sacred all that time.
Right.
That's important for any pilgrim today,
mm-hmm.
who goes to the Holy Land, who goes to Jerusalem, who goes to the Church of the Nativity, who goes to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, because he can know that these sites were held, that we know where they were from all those from all those ages. And so Bishop Alexander does the same thing. Now, when he gets there, there is a bishop of Capitolina of Jerusalem. His name is Narcissus, and he's very, very old. I think he's in his 90s at this point. And so the young Alexander arrives. He's on this pilgrimage. People show him around. He's this wonderful visit. When it comes time for him to leave, the people of Jerusalem would not let him leave. They said, no, you have to stay here. You have to be our bishop. And he agreed to do that only on because of three things. First of all, the people said that they had seen a sign in the sky. And we don't know what that was, but they said that they had seen something that portended his coming to Jerusalem. Secondly, the people wanted it. They had given their consent to this, that including the priests of Jerusalem, including the bishop, Bishop Narcissus. So this is not a guy who's coming in and usurping. And so the bishop wants him to stay also and to be a successor. And then also all the bishops around Palestine came to Jerusalem, and they consecrated him as Bishop of Jerusalem, laying hands on him. And so he accepted that. Here you have a very interesting incident that takes place. I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think it's the first time that you actually have a bishop who translates dioceses. This is the first time that a bishop leaves a diocese to become the bishop of another diocese.
Okay.
So Alexander of Cappadocia becomes Alexander of Jerusalem. And secondly, I think it's the first time in the history of the church where we actually have a bishop serving as a coadjutor. You know, while there's another ordinary in that diocese, he then takes over the administration of that diocese. Both of those, of course, are very frequent experiences today.
Now, right.
But I think this might be the first time that happened.
Hmm.
This is a time that is very rich in church history, even if you have these persecutions going on. This is the time when Origen visits the governor of Arabia in order to instruct him in the faith. He then goes to Caesarea and founds the library there. This is the time where Albertius of Hierapolis has his inscription, which we talked about several weeks ago. This is the time when there is a conflict between Hippolytus and Callistus, and eventually the two of them are martyred. The Synod of Carthage in 218 takes place at this time. Origen publishes his first principles. Sabellianism is condemned. St. Callistus is martyred. You have the pontificates of Pope St. Urban, Pontemian, Fabian. This is the time when Origen goes to Arabia and has the interview with Bishop Berulus concerning the use of the word gods, in the three gods and one God in the Trinity.
Right.
Remember that one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. This is the time when he publishes the great work Contra Celsum. This is the time of Bishop Dionysius of Alexander. There's a lot of stuff going on.
That is a very active time in the church history.
And here's another side, too. This is a time for books and the accumulation of books. Now, we have already Origen setting up the library at Caesarea, which is going to be a huge thing in the future. But also, there's a very interesting story of a not very well-known character. His name is Sixtus Julius Africanus. And he was an officer in the Roman cavalry. He was also a convert to Christianity. This is a man who was born of Roman stock in Aelia Capitolina, in Jerusalem. He became an officer in the Roman cavalry, served under Septimus Severus. At one time, during one of the campaigns in the east, while he was at the city of Edessa, in 195, he met the king of Edessa, who was himself a Christian. And it seems as though the two of them had something in common from the beginning, and that was archery. They loved to hunt using bow and arrow on horseback. And so he was impressed by this king, who then impressed him with his Christianity, and so he was converted then. He then went back to Alexandria. He went to Alexandria, attended the lectures of Heraclius, who is the successor of Origen.
Okay.
He retired to Emmaus. Do you remember Emmaus? Luke's
Gospel? Yeah, I remember Emmaus.
Yes. He would have retired probably around 47 years old. That was the age of retirement for a Roman soldier. While in Emmaus, that is in Palestine, he got to know Origen. They became good friends. And at one point, the Emperor Alexander Severus asked him, I'm saying Sixtus Julius Africanus, to come to Rome to organize the imperial library in Rome.
Wow.
So then here's a fellow who was a friend of the organizer of the library in Caesarea. And so he goes to Rome. He's given the Pantheon. That's where the library is going to be. And so he does that. And, of course, because he's a Christian, he gives a bias to Christian authors. So what a wonderful opportunity. He influences, either it's through his influence or the influence of Alexander Severus's mother, who had received instructions, remember, from Origen.
Right.
But we know for a fact that the imperial chapel, there's a prayer chapel, in the palace that the emperor uses for his private prayer. There are four statues in that chapel. There's a statue of Orpheus, another of Abraham, another of Apollonius, and another of Christ. So Alexander's trying to work this thing out.
He's trying to figure out, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's doing a little syncretism, not as crazy as his half-brother, but or his brother, but a little syncretism there. Eventually, Sixtus Julius Africanus ends up doing a lot of writing himself. He puts together a set of books called the Kestoi, which means the embroideries, and there are 24 volumes. It's meant to be something of a ancient form of encyclopedia. Except it's not arranged alphabetically.
Okay.
It's like he wrote about whatever he wanted to, whenever he wanted to. After this, he returns to Emmaus, died in 240 A.D. And there in, of course, Emmaus is not far from Jerusalem. We know that from the scriptures. He goes to Jerusalem where he establishes the Episcopal library in Jerusalem. And this will include not only the works of Origen, but also because he had been in Rome and because he had been involved in the copying of Roman Christian texts, he brings back the entire library of Hippolytus.
Wow.
And so there's another set then that's there. Well, after the murder of Alexander Severus, you end up with another emperor, this brute by the name of Maximus Thrax. And he's terrible. Again, the Romans have bought off more than what they want to chew. And he confiscates the treasury temples all throughout the empire. He begins taxing people right and left. When finally two Roman senators rise up against him, he murders the two of them. And then he comes up with this idea of confiscating the funds. And that's another way to enrich himself.
Yes.
Well, eventually he himself is murdered by the Praetorians. And so the troops then turn to another fellow by the name of Maximus. And, you know, without going into all kinds of details, the fact of the matter is that he himself is murdered by his troops. Another, in Syria, the legions rise up, and they put their general as emperor, and he ends up becoming the emperor. He's known in Roman history as Philip the Arab, or the Romans referred to him as Philippus Arabs. He's actually the son of an Arab sheikh. And remember that Arabia is a Roman province by this mm-hmm. point. And he's a very interesting fellow. This is the first time that the Romans had an Arab as their emperor. He's very sympathetic to Christianity.
Hmm.
And we know for a fact that when he was in the East, he attended Mass on occasion. Whether he was Christian or not, we're pretty sure he was not. And the reason for that is that he happened to be in Antioch on Holy Saturday. And as his custom, he would go in to attend Mass. However, as he walked in on Holy Saturday's services, the bishop who was conducting the service went over to the emperor, took him by the hand, and walked him out of the cathedral and put him out with the penitents, and said, "You can't come in unless you're baptized." So, and the response was, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know."
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Pretty incredible. Well, we're kind of lucky that he was the emperor in 248 A.D. And the reason was that was the year that Rome celebrated its 1,000th birthday. And as a result of that, there was all throughout the empire, and especially in Rome, a very strong adherence. There was a populist movement of the restoration of Roman paganism, and with that, an antagonism toward Christianity. And so there could have been a huge uproar of persecutions, but that didn't happen. Luckily, because of him. Philip the Arab, unfortunately, was murdered by his own troops while he was on maneuvers in Germany. The leader of the conspiracy was a man by the name of Dacius. And the Dacian persecutions are really going to be very, very brutal. These are going to... For one thing, he's going to have control of the entire empire, and every citizen, and now Caracalla had made everyone in the Roman Empire a citizen, had to go and sacrifice to the gods for the health of the empire. And this was to be done all throughout the empire. Here's the first time you really have an empire-wide persecution of Christians. Until that time, you'd have spurts, different cities, different provinces.
Right.
But here's an empire-wide. It's being done by the imperial government itself. And everyone was instructed to go to their local courthouse and then to give a little sacrifice to a god. And when they did that, they would receive a certificate called a libellus when it would be done. And the man that oversaw this was a censor who was a brute of an individual, too. His name was Valerianus. And with that, you're going to have then the martyrdom of St. Fabius of Rome, the Bishop of Rome, of Babylos of Antioch, the Patriarch of Antioch, Alexander of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. who we've just been mm-hmm. talking about, will be taken then, and he'll be killed too. Cyprian of Carthage is going to go into hiding. Dionysius of Alexandria is going to go into hiding. Origen is going to be captured, beaten up, taken to Tyre, where he'll die of his wounds. So this is that Dacian persecution. It's the second worst persecution in Christian history. The next one with Diocletian will be even worse. And these are going to have a huge, huge impact on the body of the church, as we'll see a little bit later on. Besides the physical attacks, there are also intellectual attacks that are going to be coming on them. For instance, you have Celsus and the writings of Celsus. Now, anyone that's willing to read Origen will see that Celsus is put in his place, but a lot of Romans would not. Other intellectuals are turning to some of the other great minds of the era, Plotinus, and following after that, Porphyry. All of these men are anti-Christian. And so Christianity is going to be attacked. The body of Christ is going to be attacked from the intellectual and the academic world, as well as from the governmental world. And so as we go on, then we're going to see, particularly in the life of Saint Cyprian of Carthage, how the church weathers this and how she prepares herself for yet another persecution, which will be the greatest in Christian history.
Well, it seems hard to think that we could then recover from anything worse than what we just did here.
Yeah.
So Dacius was second to Diocletian as the greatest persecution of the
And because
the
he was able to do this all throughout the empire mm-hmm. simultaneously, there was no running away. You couldn't do, you couldn't run off to Cappadocia.
All right.
That's not going to happen.
Well, all right. They went and got Alexander.
Yes.
Alexander.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we're just, Dionysius of Alexandria and Cyprian were just darn lucky to be able to hide the way they did.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Obviously, a few people survive because.
Yes.
Where would we be?
Yes, that's right.
All right. Well, Father, can we close today with a prayer and your blessing?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Amen. Thank you, Father.
Okay.